Good morning, Calvary.
Good morning.
I am not your usual stander in this pulpit person. Sally and Maria are taking some much-earned, much-needed rest and season of gratitude with some family, and it's a gift to get to stand here in this spot that Pastor Elijah and Pastors Sally and Maria speak to us from every week. Thank you for your gift of song. What a way to start this week of Thanksgiving. Because my people, the countdown is on. The countdown is on for holiday watchers and list makers and advertisers and marketers and merchandisers and retailers. The countdown is on. It's 4 days until Thanksgiving. It's 37 days until Christmas morning. It is, I can hear the gasp, and I hear you. Mm-hmm. It's why I'm saying the numbers. It's 43 days until the year we will write is 2019. 4 days until Thanksgiving. For some of you, and I heard you already, when you say those numbers, 4 days, 37 days, your mind immediately went to your to-do list, right? Suddenly you started thinking about, shopping and cooking and inviting and cleaning or reserving and hosting and wrapping and baking and decorating and preparing and juggling and driving and taking a moment and flying or packing and checking your list again. But that's where your mind went, right? 4 days, time, the number of hours. You might be counting down this holiday season, Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever your holidays look like, with great joy. You may be thinking, in 3 days, this person I love is coming to be with me, or I'm going to where they am. In a few days, you're going to be surrounded by love and food and pie. That may be what you're thinking. But you also might be anxious about all of the gathering and the people you might be with. You might be anxious about the people you're not going to see for whatever reason. Or, like many people, you might be counting down the end of holiday season. Not to the beginning, but you just want to get through it. So you're counting down to the end because too often what the beginning of holiday season means is a season of grief. It means dreading memories or pains or ghosts or whatever that holiday brings with it. Either way, all of us are counting down something all the time. Early in my childhood, every year we had Advent calendars, and it was a big deal. Like, we got to go to Kmart and pick them out. Now, these were not the fancy, now on Pinterest boards, wooden Santa villages with wooden doors that open up and ornaments on the inside or Belgian chocolate or whatever. Mm-mm. These were paper. They were usually bent a little bit. They also weren't like the wine and cheese Advent calendars that are out now. That, let me just say, that's my love language and I need to get me one of those. This was paper, and it was usually glittery, kind of a frosty blue color, with an ethereal picture of Mary and Jesus and Joseph under the stable, and there were wise men and shepherds, and all the animals were bowing down, and the golden light of the star was shining on their faces. They were all white, their faces. But I digress. I loved opening those doors. The little paper, you would peel them open. They were perforated. You could hear that, and there was a little message, a scripture or something inside. And we counted down to Christmas Eve. I loved the Advent calendar. We're always counting down to something, looking forward to it. 4 days until Thanksgiving, 37 days until Christmas, 11 minutes until the Green Line train comes. 2 minutes left in the game before your team wins, 2 days until the weekend, too long until the next payday, waiting to be 16 years old to drive or 18 years old to vote or 21 to drink or 16 to retire, counting down the next birthday or holiday or anniversary or celebration or promotion or graduation or election day. Are we there yet, Mom? We are always counting down, looking forward. How much longer? When's it going to happen? It, whatever it is, we're always counting down. We've always been asking the question, as Jessica stood and read the scripture from the Gospel of Mark. Let me tell you what, Mark doesn't mess around. The Gospel of Mark, he just kind of tells it like it is. He's got his stories, he runs through the parables, he tells them, and this is one in the 13th chapter of Mark. Jesus came out of the temple, and one of his disciples said to him, "Look, do you see these large stones? What large buildings." And then Jesus asked him, "Do you see these? Not a stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." Jesus had told them, "Hey guys, the walls are about to come tumbling down." And later when they had them, when he had Jesus alone, do you know what the disciples asked him? "Hey, yo, when's this gonna happen?" That's their question. When? At this moment, Jesus is your mom driving the car, trying to get you somewhere with a message, a story, something personal, and you're in the back seat going, "Yeah, are we there yet? When is this going to happen?" Jesus is your teacher trying to help you learn something, and all you're doing is packing up your backpack, waiting on the bell to ring. Jesus is trying to teach you something. It doesn't say this in the text, but I'm pretty sure Jesus does this. Because the scripture reads like this. Then Jesus began to say to them, and the then was this: "Man, I've been telling you and telling you and telling you. And your question is when?" So here's what Jesus says: "Beware that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name and say, 'I am he.' And they will lead many astray. But when you hear wars and rumors of wars, don't be alarmed. This must take place. The end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places. There will be famines and fires." Does this sound familiar, like what's happening now? And then Jesus says, "This is but the beginning of the birth pangs." It also doesn't say this next part, but I'm pretty sure one of those disciples, after that speech about what is to come, says, "Yeah, when did you say that was going to happen?" The disciples had the same impatience, obsession with time. How long, Jesus? What's the sign? How will we know? When is it going to happen? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Jesus had laid a lot at their feet, not just in that moment, but in the days prior to that. It's like Jesus is trying to cram in every piece of wisdom and knowledge that they are going to need for what is going to come. He knows that time is short. His time with them is short. He has so much to say, and he also knows his followers, that means us, are struggling to get the message. They're caught up in the schedule. When's it going to happen? In the chapter before this one, in chapter 12, Jesus had been in the temple and he'd been questioning every seat of power, every person of authority. He was being questioned by religious leaders. He was being watched and he was challenging power and going toe to toe with the people who owned that power. After each of the three or four parables that happened in chapter 12, right before our story where he goes, "Oh, disciples, listen to me." The people around him wanted to arrest him. He told a parable that was against them, but they were afraid, and so they left. After the next parable, when he questioned the laws, his reply left them overcome with wonder, it says. In the next parable, when he talked about the widow and who is to marry whom and where money goes, the scriptures say no one dared to ask him any more questions. Y'all, these people were shook. They did not know what was about to come. Jesus had told story and challenged the hierarchy power of the day. Who gets paid? Who decides what the tax rate is? The marriage structure. Jesus was being asked to pass a religious litmus test. Does any of this sound like what we're going through now? He had walked the halls of Congress, the steps of the courthouse, the aisles of the church, and said, "Something around here just isn't right. Do you see these great buildings?" he said. "Not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." And to this his disciples say, "Yeah, when is that happening? When? Seriously, that's your question?" See, the disciples are asking the wrong question. And I really can't fault them, because I have asked the wrong question many, many times. In grad school, when I was getting my theology degree, we had to do a year of supervised ministry. Mine was done at a homeless center and a downtown church in Fort Worth, Texas. And on my very first day, mind you, I knew nothing about this kind of work. I showed up and found that I was the new director. I knew nothing. And luckily, I had a dedicated staff of about 50 volunteers that just ran the place seamlessly. It's good that I didn't need to know anything, because they knew everything, and I screwed up several times in a pretty big way. On this very first day, they show me to my office, and I'm given the tour by the head volunteer, and he's like, "This is your office, and this is the clothing closet, and here's the food pantry, and here's where we do computer classes, and this is where we do literacy training," and he's giving me the whole rundown of this incredible day resource center that they're running. The person who had the job before me had vacated the position so quickly that nothing was taken from the office. I start going through the desk drawers, and there's like chapstick and bobby pins and personal notes, and I don't know what to do with this. I'm kind of gathering everything up. It's August in Texas, which means it's not cool outside. This space is not air conditioned, so I'm in my office 100% overwhelmed with what I've been tasked to do, feeling grateful for these people who know what's happening. Because every morning at 8 o'clock, about 200 people lined up outside our door to get a sack lunch before they went out to find work or wait in line at whatever resource they were going to that day to try to get an ID or a job or their social security benefits or disability or whatever they needed to do. The very first thing we did was hand them a meal. So I'm in my office on that very first day cleaning personal items out of a desk of a person that I had never met, and it is hot. It's like sweaty Texas hot. And there's a ceiling fan in this very old office, and I am trying every light switch. Nothing is making the ceiling fan come on. But inside the desk drawer, I find the remote control. It's a pretty high ceiling, so there was no kind of pull cord. I thought it's got to be a light switch or the remote control. And it was exactly like the remote control that my parents had in their very tall, old ceiling, too. So I'm pushing the button, and it's not working. It's hot. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm frustrated. I can't make the fan work. And I decide, you know what? Let me go out and learn. Let me learn some things. So I decide I'm going to go across the hall. I'm going to learn about the clothing closet. This was run by three women like a tight ship. I mean, when you came in, you got your stuff, you left. They totally knew what they were doing. As I walk out of my office into the clothing closet, they are sorting and folding, and it's school uniforms. And as they're explaining to me what is about to happen as the children come in to get their school clothes, the door of the center bursts open, and there are three police officers with guns drawn. And they say, "Everyone get on the floor." Well, I got on the floor, but my volunteers have like new hips. I mean, it was hard for them to get on the floor. And so we're like, "No, what is happening?" And they said, "We've gotten the emergency alert. Where's the danger? What's the crisis? Where do we need to go?" And we're all like looking around at each other like, "What is the crisis? Check the doors. But what's the emergency procedure?" And we don't know. We're looking around. And one of them says to me, "Who pushed the panic button?" "Do you mean the remote control for the ceiling fan?" I might have pushed it 45 times. I took the batteries out, put them back in, and pushed it some more. On that same day, I met my very, they left, we were all fine, I felt like an idiot. That very same day, we had our first line of people come through, and I was at the front desk kind of learning the process. They would come and sign in and get their lunch, and we would say good morning, and they would go on about their day. And the very last person in the line was a man I got to know extremely well over the 4 years that I was there. He went by California because that's where he was from, and so that's what we all called him. And he's the last one to come in, and we'd give out the sack lunches until they're gone. And so he was the very last one. He waited to come in. We were out of lunches, and he leans on the counter at me, and he goes, "You don't know what you're doing, do you?" Now, that was the correct question, because I did not. And he said, "Let me explain to you." And he went through explaining to me how people would try to scan the system and who I needed to look out for and what the best process was and where I should be standing. He taught me everything I needed to know. And he said, "What do you want to know from me?" Well, I was frustrated that we had turned people away. We didn't have enough. And I said to him, "How do we feed more people? How do we get more food? How do we feed more people?" And he looked at me and said, "That's the wrong question. You're asking the wrong question." And I said, "But we want to feed more." And he said, "You do not. You want there to be fewer people who need to be fed." And I realized I was asking the wrong question. So I really can't fault the disciples for asking, "Hey, when is this going to happen?" I just imagined an endless supply of, he said, "No, we don't want people to need this service. You're asking the wrong question. If we fix the root of the problem, if we get people the services they need, they won't have to come here." He said, "Girl, you need to start working yourself out of a job." And I thought, well, after this, how this morning went, that may not be far down the road. So I asked the wrong question. The disciples asked the wrong question. It's like in this day and age, we can't help it. We want to know when things are going to happen. We're fond in this church of marking an occasion. Maria likes to talk about marking a moment. Sometimes it's a beautiful moment. Sometimes it's when we're filled with joy and love, and we want that memory etched in our souls forever. Sometimes the things we need to remember are moments that burn darkly into us. Things in our collective memory that we wish we could forget but should not ever. We have had too many of those moments lately in this world. It's 4 days until Thanksgiving. It's 37 days until Christmas. It's also only been 22 days since 11 people were murdered at the Tree of Life Synagogue. It's been 226 days since 2,342 children were put in cages on our border. It's been 46 days since a Senate judicial confirmation vote said to women, "Be quiet." It's been 665 days since protesters stood on the steps of this very church and said that the God that we love and who loves us does not look the same as theirs. It's been 740 days since the 2016 presidential election. It's been 1,250 days since the Charleston shooting at Mother Emanuel Church. It's been 889 days since the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, 464 since the KKK and Nazi supporters marched with torches in Charlottesville. It's been 866 since Alton Sterling's murder, and 7,342 since Matthew Shepard was tied to a fence in Wyoming and died. 180 years since the Trail of Tears, 399 since African bodies and souls were brought to this country in chains, 12 days since the midterm elections, and 7 days since Shamel Robinson was shot by police for detaining a shooter. So that means it's 0 days since we stand here and ask, are we there yet? Are we there yet? How much longer? How much more? Maybe the disciples weren't asking the wrong question. Jesus said to them, beware that no one leads you astray. Many will come in my name. They will try to lead you astray. But the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places and famines. But this is but the beginning of the birth pangs. This is but the beginning. The beginning, Jesus? Did you not just hear that list I read? The beginning? But it is the beginning of the birth pangs. Birth is a lot of things. And let me say, as a person who has never given birth, I feel like we should have had a mother's moment down here where we let people who have talk about what that is. But giving birth is a lot of things. It's messy and beautiful and terrifying and overwhelming and emotional. There is screaming. There is blood. But there's also transformation. And when Jesus talks about birth pangs, I think he's talking about transformation. Everyone involved is transformed. Birth brings new life, and if you have had a child, you know this to be true, complete disruption of everything you know that is normal. That's the birth Jesus is talking about. The beginning of the birth pangs in the world, in the temple, in the government, in our lives, it is a disruption. When the walls come tumbling down, that's what this means. See, the disciples want to know when it's going to happen. They're looking at kind of the end game. Really, the disciples are 1950s dads in the waiting room at the hospital waiting to hand out cigars. When can I pass these out? Has it happened? Has it happened yet? And the work is going on in the birthing chamber. The screaming, the crying, the fighting, the pleading with God. When Pastor Elijah talked about with the children's moment, what it means for the world to change. There's a movie that he pointed out to me and we talked about last week. It's Serafina, and you have not watched it, you should. It's about apartheid in South Africa and in Soweto, the rising up and what people did to claim their freedom. There's a scene where after they have fought and rioted and people have died, the preacher says to them, they fear you because you are young. They fear you because you are the future. How fearful they must be to shoot your children. How powerful you must be that they fear you so much. You are powerful because you are the generation that will be free. The violence, the beatings, the tortures, the killings, all of this is the birth pain of our free nation. It's the birth pangs of now. This is what we're walking through. The disciples asked the question, when? And really what we ought to be asking is, why and how and what? Why have these systems survived? Why have we allowed this long of the human story to go where we put people in boxes of worthy and not worthy, and loved and unloved, and beloved and not beloved? We need to ask, what can I do in my own sphere of influence? What can I do with the people I connect to? And we need to ask how we keep moving forward. Not a when, but a why and a how and a what. It's no wonder in our nation's capital in D.C. that we often get caught up in the political stories of the land. And this week, 2 days ago, Stacey Abrams, the should-be governor of Georgia, in her speech, not her concession speech, but in her speech, said this. And I think it's the words that Jesus was trying to say to his disciples. I implore each of you to not give in to that anger or apathy, but instead turn to action. Because the antidote to injustice is progress. The cure to this malpractice is a fight for fairness. Pundits and hyperpartisans will hear my words as a rejection of the normal order. I'm supposed to say nice things and accept my fate. They will complain that I should not use this moment to recap what was done wrong or demand a remedy. As a leader, they want me to be stoic in my outrage and silent in my rebuke. But stoicism is a luxury, and silence is a weapon for those who would quiet the voices of the people. I will not concede. I will not concede. So this is the answer to the questions that we find in a political speech. The answer to the question that the disciples were asking Jesus. Don't give in to anger or apathy. Turn to action. Reject the normal order. When Jesus said to his people, the stones shall be moved, they shall fall down. That's rejection of the normal order. And finally, do not concede. Don't concede. We don't have to concede. We can find some hope in this day. When I first started thinking about what this week would be, what this Sunday before Thanksgiving would be, my mind went to my two favorite things about Thanksgiving, which is my favorite holiday. Thanksgiving for me is about gratitude and pie. I can't rank them in order because I'm not sure which one I would pick. Pie and gratitude. It's easy to talk about pie. I'll save that. But gratitude can be hard in the face of hate. Gratitude can be hard in the face of fear. Gratitude can be hard in the face of injustice. It can feel impossible when the weight of the world is on your shoulders. But here's some things to be grateful for. It's been 1,241 days since marriage equality was the law of the land. It's been 739 days since millions of women and their allies marched in the streets around the world. It's been 12 days since 106 women and Muslims and Native Americans and people of color and LGBTQ folk were elected to the halls of Congress. It's been 156 years since this very congregation said, we can do things a different way. And it's been 680 days when this congregation said that again and unanimously voted to call our pastors to lead us. We will not concede. It's also been 3 days since Ruth Bader Ginsburg broke her ribs and get back to work. So people, we have no excuse. And at 0 days, which is where we are right now, we get to look around this room, this space, this place, at the faces in it, and keep loving and fighting and refusing to concede. We have a voice. We can speak. We can act. And when it is hard to feel grateful, know that you have this place, these people, this moment that has gathered in a coalition of fighters and yellers and prayers, lamenters, protectors, protesters, human shields, people that have you in their hands. It's not easy. This is just the beginning of the birth pains. What I say to that is, all right, Jesus, we're ready. Pray with me, please. God, we're ready. We're ready for the walls to come tumbling down. We're ready to stand together. We're ready to seek your face. God, we're also ready to soak in the gratitude of what this season is about to be. God, thank you for each person in this place. And God, thank you for pie. Amen.